Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy!
Hello, everyone. We are here tonight on Our Thoughts Tonight. And
hello.
Zach is here. Sean is here. And unfortunately, Ashok is not here tonight, which it's our first episode without Ashok. He wanted to be safe and quarantine because he thinks he might have been exposed to COVID-19. So I hope he's okay, and I think he's doing a good thing.
And he's in our thoughts tonight.
He is in our thoughts tonight. As always, we're going to go ahead and start with our song that we always begin the night with, Crucem Sanctam. Tonight.
Hello.
How is everybody doing tonight? Anyone that's listening out there? I hope you're doing okay. Zach, how are you?
I'm groovy. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Doing good. Yeah. We're kind of getting used to this.
We're missing the third peg.
Yeah, exactly. Chair. Ashok holds it down.
He talks
and
way too fast.
I'm usually the one that's on the computer that is making sure we aren't screwing up in terms of sound. So this is going to be an interesting episode.
We also have Sean here too.
Sean is here, yeah. And Sean definitely helps us as well.
Good evening, folks.
And Zach and I have been talking about serial killers in Alaska specifically and elsewhere in the world. Who were you reading about earlier, Zach?
Thomas Richard Bundy, or Bundy.
The Alaskan?
He's not. I don't think he's related to Ted Bundy. He might be, though. I don't know. But it was the first successful use of psychological profiling of killers in Alaska.
Really?
Yeah.
By the BAU, FBI?
Yeah.
And interesting.
There was 5 murders in Fairbanks between 1979 and 1981, working for the Air Force Base in Fairbanks. And then he got transferred to Wichita Falls in Texas. And an hour before his warrant, his arrest has been issued. And then he took the coward's way out by, like, going on a motorcycle crash into a dump truck and commit suicide. Yeah, that's one of many cases.
That is pretty brutal. I've been reading a lot of statistics about serial killers specifically in Alaska because I am a criminal justice minor. So I was writing a paper about investigation related to Israel Keyes, the one of the more recent serial killers in Alaskan history. So I got some really interesting data with a population of 285,634, which makes Alaska the largest city in the state of Alaska. I mean, Anchorage, yeah, sorry. Anchorage is the largest city in the state of Alaska. City is obviously known for its wildlife and its beautiful panoramic views and global tourism. But it's no stranger to violent crime, as we know. The crime rate in Anchorage is higher than 98.3% of cities in the United States. Isn't that crazy, Zach? And the likelihood of a person becoming a victim of a violent crime is 1 in 76. Yet I feel like we don't hear about Anchorage or Alaska very much, except for the few serial killers that have been around here. We don't hear about it. Like, you know, most of the time when you hear about crazy violent crime, you think about California, New York, like Son of Sam and stuff like that, Chicago with all the gangs and all that.
Do you think that could be largely because of our small population, that it's a very, very high percentage, but that adds up to a much lower total than, say, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it makes the by populace, it's I think it seems a little exaggerated.
There's smaller communities, but a lot of land.
Yeah.
A lot of unknown land. Even if it is known, a lot of people that are in the small communities, or like Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau or wherever, all the villages in between and the forests in between, it's a huge state. There's a lot of unknown ground where things could occur and take place. And usually you don't find out about it until after it's already happened and it's broadcasted on the news.
Oh, Anchorage, Alaska in general, really. But there's a lot of theories that experts and locals have. A lot of people speculate on the reason of high crime rates in Alaska. One theory is the lack of sunlight, which at point is about 18 hours of darkness during a 24-hour period in Anchorage. In other places, I think it's complete darkness for a lot longer than that. Temperatures regularly below freezing, that has an effect, potentially. An environment with conditions like this is perfect for someone running from the law, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would.
Well, the northernmost part of Alaska is definitely inside the Arctic Circle.
Uh-huh.
And that means it's dark for 6 months out of the year.
6 months out of the year.
And I've been up there a number of times, and the temperature sometimes, I've been up there in October, not in December, but even in late October, the temperature sometimes dips down to 40 below zero.
Wow.
So what you have is you have darkness and you have extreme cold, which means people don't go out much.
That's true. Yeah. There's a theory done in, or there's a study done in New Zealand here. Let me pull this up here that I was just reading about last night. Got to reach in my bag of research literature.
Oop.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the darkness too also is a reason why people drink so much. You know.
What's the psychological state they get into from lack of light?
A seasonal affective disorder, I believe.
Yeah, from lack of light.
Yeah, lack of light. Yeah.
Like cabin fever.
Isn't that how people get like bent knees and stuff too from lack of light? It's some kind of physical disorder of some sort?
Well, we all need sunlight, vitamin D. Yeah. So when we lack it, I'm no doctor, I'm no scientist, but it definitely does something to the mind. Yeah. I mean, if you consider, like up here, it's been cloudy for the last three days,
yeah.
3 or 4 days, right? Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that if you took a poll from a lot of people, they're feeling a little bit down. Not depressed, but just a little bit down,
yeah.
Sluggish from lack of sunlight.
Yeah.
And that's that vitamin D. So sunlight really is essential.
Yeah, absolutely.
Seasonal emotions,
right.
their outlook on everything in the world changes from season to season.
So
summer, a lot of people are more happy. And when it comes wintertime, everyone forgets how to drive, for one. And then everyone also gets a lot more down on themselves. And on other people.
There's a phenomenon or a continuum model, I believe. It's called the negative affect escape model. It stipulates that aggression increases with temperatures because of increases in irritation and discomfort, but only up to a certain point. At this point, the relationship changes to being negative as the discomfort increases to a level where the motivation to escape uncomfortable situations outweighs the motivation to be aggressive. Thus, there is an inverse U-shaped relationship between the temperature and aggression. As aggression increases or decreases, the expected utility of crime that releases that aggression is also increases or decreases.
That's crazy.
An environment like that is just, yeah, it's ridiculous.
So do you mean when the temperature goes up, violence increases?
Yeah, I read a different study that said it has a lot to do with the fact that when it is really warm, people tend to stay inside. Same thing, you know, when it's cold. So it kind of is on a continuum, and depending on the weather. The statistic I was talking about earlier about serial killers, Zach, I was telling you about it, said at 15.65 serial killings per 1 million inhabitants, this makes Alaska the highest rate for serial killings in proportion to its population.
That's, I don't even know what to say, but...
It's a lot of people, but...
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it is less likely. Serial killers are anomalous a little bit.
What was that one guy's name from Valley Moon of the Park?
Oh, James Dale Ritchie.
Yeah, that guy you were telling me about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a few years ago, 2016, I think.
Yeah, that was a scary time.
Yeah, it was kind of scary.
So tell the audience about him, because I really don't know the name myself. I live here in Alaska.
Yeah.
I stopped going there. I just had a kid around that time, and I was like, well, I'm not going to that park anymore.
I remember 2016, there was a few killings.
I think it was four total.
Six.
Oh, six?
I think, yeah.
Wow.
There was two down, I believe, by, not Beluga Point, Point Woronzoff, down in the trail area
yeah.
over there when you go down
the beach.
So two people were found dead there. Then two people found dead, I can't remember where the second group of two was.
I think it was at Valley in the Moon Park on a
trail.
That
was the last two.
Yeah.
Yeah. The two people unrelated. Each time, everyone that was killed was unrelated, but it was always in deuces.
In pairs of twos.
Yeah, and the last two were killed and just laid down on a park bench, I believe, in the Valley of the Moon Park. That's what I heard, at least. I don't know.
And I'm pretty sure it was all used with the same weapon.
Yeah, it was.
And that's what linked it.
It was a Magnum something revolver.
Yeah.
Which is pretty intense.
Hold on, let me look this up.
And if I remember correctly, there was a lot of fear around the trails. They were telling people not to walk around the trails.
So if I can set the scenario for those who don't know Anchorage very well, Point Woronzoff is at one of the most western, not quite the westernmost, but it's in western Alaska, it's western Anchorage on the end of the peninsula, and it's a large bluff, but the road goes down off the bluff and goes, and you can enter a parking lot and from there walk easily down onto the beach. But the beach can be very isolated. But that also is a place where a lot of people go to watch sunsets.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Or sea whales.
Or sea whales, right. Right. And so it's isolated, but it's also a very popular place where people go. It's on the other side of the airport. There's no houses out there. There's just woods and a bluff. And the other place is actually very close to downtown, Valley of the Moon Park. And a major bike trail, Chester Creek Bike Trail, runs right alongside it. And it's in a big ditch in the middle of town, which Chester Creek runs down. So
right down the hill from 15th.
Right. So 15th is basically right on the edge of downtown, changing into like basically Anchorage suburbs.
Right. Down the road a little bit from West High School.
Right. Yeah. So it's a very central area. And there's a big park there and with a playground. When I bike down there or run down there along the trail, you almost always see kids in the jungle gym and people having barbecues and parties. So it's astounding that that two dead bodies would be found in that place. But that just sets a scenario for these.
Yeah, so blatantly and open, like for anyone to walk by and see. That's the crazy part.
So the story with that, well, so for people that are in town, it was kind of scary. The weird thing is, I can't remember what the odds were of knowing somebody. That the odds of being a victim to a serial killer are very low, but the odds of knowing a somebody that was a victim to a serial killer is a little bit more likely, but still pretty low. And I've known two people personally that were victims to serial killing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One I knew very, I don't want to say very well, but I was
we both went to high school.
Yeah, with Samantha Koenig, which was killed by Israel Keyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a mess of a situation. That guy was pretty sick. But yeah, the darkness, I think it has a lot to do with how people act. And there's also other violent crimes, like lots of domestic violence. This is the most dangerous state for women.
Yeah.
And I think it's dangerous for everybody, but especially women by statistics as well.
Yeah, they're more targeted than men.
Yeah,
like.
A poor ratio
and
between.
If it is men, I feel like they're attacked because they're associated with women. Like in the park, it was in twos, and it was always like a dude and a girl, or a girl and a guy. You know.
Yeah. What were you saying, Sean?
Well, a question from you, Murat. I'm getting back to the serial killers and the darkness and the cold. My guess is, and you can give a more educated guess than I can, and that is that. I'm not sure serial killers are motivated. That's probably the wrong term, but somehow their actions are caused by cold or darkness. I have a feeling that's something more psychotic, something more ingrained.
I feel like that's one of the ingredients, but not all of it.
Yeah, for sure. If somebody already has the proclivity to do something like that, it takes stressors to trigger that, whether it's death of somebody they care about, if they are capable of caring, you know, loss of something else,
lack of empathy,
money,
that's been towards them,
whatever it is, something triggers them. Sometimes it is a drive that it's like a hunting type of a drive,
or social anxiety.
But I think the trigger is, yeah, you're right, that it's not just the weather, but
it's one of the factors.
Help.
Yeah.
Whereas on the other hand, probably a lot of domestic violence occurs in the winter as opposed to the summer? Is that?
I'm assuming so. You know, people are closed, and especially in Alaska. I haven't looked up the rates or the reasons on studies about domestic violence, but I think that could have a correlation. Definitely. We're going to go. Let's. You want to read a poem, Sean?
I don't know if I have a poem that corresponds with this thing.
Well, anything, yeah. This is it would be
this?
Hard.
No, I
what is that?
The one that you told me to look up.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Sean's going to read us a poem, and then we're going to – I actually have a – what I was going to do is I met up with a couple of other podcasts, and I promised them I would air a promo of theirs. So we're going to do a couple of those tonight as well. And then Ashok's calling in, and then he'll join us as well via phone after Sean reads his poem.
Radio man.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to read a poem that's by Ogden Nash. He was born in 1902 and died in 1971. He's an American poet. He was mostly known as a humorist. This is, you know, considering we're talking about serial killers and those who do things, this may give an ironic picture of that, but I also think that it gives a positive picture of things that we do and what we think about them. More minor sins as opposed to mortal sins. So it's called Portrait of the Artist as a Prematurely Old Man by Ogden Nash. It is common knowledge to every schoolboy and even every bachelor of arts that all sin is divided into two parts. One kind of sin is called a sin of commission, and that is very important. And it is what you are doing when you're doing something you oughtn't. And the other kind of sin is just the opposite, and is called a sin of omission, and is equally bad in the eyes of the right-thinking people, from Billy Sunday to Buddha, and it consists of not having done something you should have. I might as well give you my opinion of these two kinds of sin, as long as, in a way, against each other we are pitting them. And that is, don't bother your head about sins of commission, because however sinful, they must at least be fun, or else you wouldn't be committing them. It is the sin of omission, the second kind of sin that lays eggs under your skin. The way you get really painfully bitten is by the insurance you haven't taken out, and the checks you haven't added up the stubs of, and the appointments you haven't kept, and the bills you haven't paid, and the letters you haven't written. Also about sins of omission, there is one particular painful lack of beauty. Namely, it isn't as though it had been a riotous red letter day or night every time you neglected to do your duty. You didn't get a wicked forbidden thrill every time you let a policy lapse or forget to pay a bill. You didn't slap the lads in the tavern in the back and loudly cry, "Wee! Let's all fail to write just one more letter before we go home, and this round of unwritten letters is on me." No, you never get any fun out of the things you haven't done. But they are the things that I do not like to be amid, because the suitable things you didn't do give you a lot more trouble than the unsuitable things you did. The moral is that it is probably better not to sin at all. But if some kind of sin you must be pursuing, well, remember to do it by doing rather than by not doing.
Thank you, Sean. That was great. Now I'm going to let you guys hear a little snippet promo of the Total Chaos podcast.
Water is a plant, but if you water it, it grows.
It's true, though. No. Yeah, if you water, it grows. We can't ask Jonathan Twain, but he doesn't know what water is.
It sounds like one time I was at school, this one person I was arguing with, they were like, if you're completely submerged underwater, are you actually wet?
Hold on, I'm going to go Google the formal definition of wet.
Can I just imagine, this is straight up your mom. What define a plant?
A property of a plant that if you give it water, it grows. And if you give water, grow.
What's the definition of a plant?
Yes.
Yeah.
No!
Literally, if water is plant, then plant is water. So is the entire universe just water?
It's all a plant!
Stop being racist. All of us are water.
are back, everyone, and Ashok is joining us now.
Hello?
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 What's going on?
What's up, big boy?
I can hear you.
Okay, yeah, I'm just going to eat some chili, man. What's going on with all you guys?
What's that?
I'm just eating some chili. I hear you guys talking about criminals or whatnot in the local vicinity.
Sorry, one more time?
You said that he's eating chili dogs?
No, just chili.
Oh, that's lame. All right. Yeah, and he said that he can hear us talking about serial killers in the facility.
How are we doing without you?
You guys are doing good. Yeah, yeah. It's, four minus one. Everything's good.
We don't got that radio voice, though, bro.
Minutes, so... Huh?
I said we don't got that radio voice, though, bro.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my borderline lisp or whatever.
Yeah.
So
there's no chips.
You guys were talking. I think you guys are talking about, God, what was that one guy who like, got killed a bunch of people in town?
James Dale Ritchie?
Oh, yeah.
The Valley of the
actually,
Moon guy.
Yeah, yeah. He was actually the killer, right? I heard he was, like, not really the guy.
He was. They managed to tie the ballistics all of the weapon all to the bodies from the bodies to him.
All six of them.
Oh, okay. Well, local serial killer then.
Yeah. So, what did you have in mind if you were here? What would we be talking about?
Oh man. So in regards to serial killers, well,
anything.
Well, the one thing that, I mean, I can't say a definitive answer, but the one thing that I just thought about was, does the coronavirus really, because it prevents people from going out, is it actually a good thing in terms of serial killers, I suppose? It's just a really casual thought I had.
That's a good
transition.
Yeah, good transition. I don't know. That, I mean, we're talking about the concept of people being indoors is... making or could potentially make people more violent. I was talking to somebody I know that is a part of a not domestic violence trafficking hotline, and
mm-hmm.
when quarantine first happened, she mentioned that trafficking had gone up, and also domestic violence.
Really?
She works in law. So it could definitely be a correlation.
Wow. So it goes up. That's kind of unexpected. Huh.
That's a good question, though.
That is.
Yeah.
So how are you feeling?
Oh, well, health-wise, I'm sure you guys talked about why I'm not at the place right now, but I'm feeling fine. I guess just waiting on results.
Yeah, good call.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, so what do you think about sudden influx in coronavirus? Do you think people are actually going to take it seriously? And what effect do you think it's going to have within the next week? I mean, do you think things are going to get intense post-election?
Well, that's kind of a hard question because, like, they haven't been taking it seriously so far. So it's like, what makes you think it's going to take it seriously from now on? But it is true that I think there is a general sense of increased panic, which is kind of like good because, you know, it might facilitate an actual good response from the state. But it's kind of a tough call here in Alaska. It's like whatever action they're going to do is probably not going to be enough anyway. I'm hoping for an increase. You know, I'm hoping for a shutdown, really. But I mean, especially because of how much everything has been increasing. But we'll see what happens.
I think it's because everyone's just starting to test after X amount of months.
Yeah.
Finally, going to do it.
Respiratory illness goes up around this time of year. I mean, it's flu season.
Yeah. Allergies. Yeah. And whatnot, what have you.
I'll tell you
are,
this much.
Are you with, eating Doritos?
I was eating chili.
No. I'm opening up a bag of cheese for the chili.
Bag of cheese? It's shredded cheese, isn't it?
Yeah, shredded cheese.
Nice. Nice shredder.
Dude, teenage mutant. But at least during the election, I have a feeling it's going to be an increase of conspiracy theories. Because, I mean, you know what they're saying? Like, the whole like, conspiracy theory nowadays is like, oh, no more coronavirus after the election. That's the current craze. And, you know, I think that's going to be a little bit dangerous because, you know, conspiracies get people riled up. So,
I was watching a Trump rally today because they always come up on my feed as a live stream. I can't remember where it was, but it was being broadcast via Fox News, I think.
Oh, nice.
And he was talking about ballots. So he's already, I mean, he has been, you know, laying the foundation for a conspiratorial coup. And he was like, they're not even, they're printing, the Dems are printing new ballots and they're just gonna, they're gonna dump them all in and make it, or he was saying that because the votes can't be counted the day of, the Democratic states are going to add more ballots by, you know, waiting a few days. And it's like they could have done that before the election, you know. They don't have to wait till after the election to add fake absentee ballots.
It could have already been pre-planned if that was the case.
Well,
that's the whole scare. It's just worrisome because, like, if Trump calls BS and prevents a peaceful transition of power, then, like,
what do you do in that situation? He is commander-in-chief, you know.
Yeah, do you think that there is a potential for him to, you know, just sit on the position and refuse to leave? And what would happen if,
I think it's
if
small.
He does?
I think it's small, but I think it's still possible. And if it happens, I mean, America has decent enough institutions to hold him down, or push him away, but it's the possibility still there, which makes it even worse. That's even a possibility. That's terrible. You know?
Yeah. What institutions like the FBI?
More in a general sense, like the whole like actual traditions of the United States, which might hold up in the military, or in the FBI, or in the Supreme Court. Like there is enough tradition, I suppose. I'll take that back a little bit because Trump has shaken up the system to a certain extent, but I think still there's enough of a dislike towards anti-authoritarianism that there's enough of that to possibly, you know, prevent that from happening. But you know, something certain.
What about the Supreme Court now being on his side?
Yeah, see that. I know that's the worst part because it's like. I mean, the new judge is, they like to claim that she's like a moderate, but she's really not. It's just, it's quite dangerous because it's like, that's honestly probably the most likely in terms of any actual damage being done, whether it be Roe v. Wade or something else. It's because of that judge, you know. It's not really, although I think there's a risk of Trump not leaving office, it's a real danger actually in that Supreme Court and what's going to happen from now on with, you know, with a likely Biden presidency, you know.
Yeah, that's, I don't know, it's all messed up.
Everything's spookazzy.
I think the implications on society are going to be really interesting to watch because I was for anyone listening that doesn't know, I am a crisis intervention counselor on a suicide hotline, and there was 500 people on queue waiting to speak to a crisis counselor.
Yeah, hey, you told me that like
normally,
2 nights ago or something.
Yeah,
like
last night.
Yeah, last night.
Normally on a Friday night, on a normal evening, at the most 50 people. At the most. And that's only for about an hour, 2 hours, you know, at the peak of it. But it was 500 people for hours.
Do you think that has to do with isolation and coronavirus?
Isolation, coronavirus, stress from the news.
Paranoia.
Politics are being pumped hard this year.
Yeah.
How about the election in the Supreme Court?
Yeah, the election in the Supreme Court. I mean, so many
a lot of
factors,
variables.
So many factors.
Well, wasn't the Supreme Court decision just yesterday?
Yeah, I believe so.
So that would be an immediate instigator.
Yeah.
And I think if I were, and I am, Joe Public, I think I would be more concerned if I was paying attention to who's on the Supreme Court than who's president.
Yeah, definitely. They make the big decisions, really.
And it also could just be at-home problems or everyday struggles
the weather.
Yeah, the weather and the seasonal emotional change.
What?
Well, what'd you
that's
say?
Pretty important because, well, that's pretty important because, like, the election obviously is probably an instigator of that, and the Supreme Court in a sense as well. But it's like, it's really the immediate danger that probably does that, and it's just it's worse because those immediate problems are made worse by these larger decisions. And especially, you know, with obviously with COVID and everything, but it's just, I don't know. It's just, you know, it's good to just focus on like what's more immediate. Like, you know, the president seems important, but it's also like valuable to really do something with local elections and whatnot, because those will affect your, you know, mental state probably much, you know, more directly than, you know, whatever happens in D.C. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Last week, around the time of the debate, I didn't even really watch the debate. And last week, I wasn't even closely following politics. But even I had insomnia and I woke up, you know, just, you know, when you have weird, like, repeating thoughts when you're half asleep sometimes and about things in your life. It was about politics.
It's like a Ferris wheel.
Yeah. And I was like, what am I doing? I felt like I was stressing out. And I'm not somebody that is a stressed out person. So I could imagine somebody with high stress levels in being highly affected by this.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't sleep for 2 days for some reason. And there was no reason for me not to be sleeping.
On and off. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Who do you think is going to win, Ashok?
Oh, it's Biden by a long shot. I mean, the polls in general, like, it's so set and done. Honestly, people give crap about the polls, like, but polls are accurate. Like 2016, the polls were accurate. The only thing they got wrong was the predictions were wrong, but the polls themselves were correct. And if you look at the polls now, it's so set and done. Like Florida is. Well, now it's a little bit deadlocked, but a week ago, Florida was, like, firmly in Biden's favor. And that's just Florida. All the other states, literally every other state except, like, Ohio is really, you know, it's either Biden's by a long shot or Biden leading. And Trump needs to win, like, for example, Trump needs to win Pennsylvania or Florida and then a few more states. He's literally behind on all of them except Ohio. Like, it's, I mean, even states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota, where these were like the surprise states that Trump won, Biden is comfortably winning them. Like, it's said and done. Like, Clinton wasn't
Obama's backing him too.
Huh?
I said Obama's backing him too and making speeches like right after where Trump's making speeches.
Well,
I think that happened on one occasion at least.
Yeah, in Florida.
Yeah, in Florida.
Well, Obama was effective in his talks against Trump, so that's good.
Yeah.
again, but the real danger is the vote counting in general and Trump's reaction to it. That's pretty much the only hypothetical where Trump might win. Well, not really win, but stay in office.
Bernie has been talking about that, going on like the Jimmy Fallon show and saying like, you know, we have to be prepared. I'm sure there's a contingency plan.
Yeah.
I would hope.
There's got to be something set in place, hopefully.
It's funny because, like, what happens afterward with Trump, you know, let's say he actually does leave office, whatever. The whole thing back in 2016 was, oh, Trump did all of this to start up a media outlet, basically. And the same rumors are going on of, like, Trump starting, like, a Trump TV news outlet, which is interesting because overall, if Trump wins, it's going to do a lot of damage to the right, not just in elections, but, like, if Trump, and it's almost borderline confirmed at this point that Trump is probably going to do some sort of media thing afterward, like in terms of like news, like One American News or something small but conservative. In that scenario, you would have a split of the conservative party really against, you know, Fox News or whatever, like your listener in, you know, just, I don't know, like, you know, Valley in California or something, and then you have your split with like Deep South Trump voters. And I don't know, because I mean, Trump's already like going against Fox News and whatnot. So I don't know. I'm just interested into what happens after the election with whatever Trump's gonna do. And because usually like Trump voters, like not voters, but usually candidates who lose are usually shunned away from the party. But Trump has that base, so Trump's gonna keep his base and get shunned out from the party if he loses. That's a split of the Republican Party, hypothetically.
Yeah,
there's what's his name? I think last name Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband, has the Lincoln Project. Have you heard of those guys?
Oh yeah. I think they're kind of a joke, but yeah, Lincoln Project.
Yeah, it's hilarious. I mean, they're the like
the joke.
They're like the Bush Republicans just hating on Trump hardcore. I don't know. I'm excited for this to be over so this doesn't become the topic of the week every week like it has been for the last 3 weeks.
Yeah. Unwillingly, but it's also subconsciously in the back of our mind, so it's just always brought up over and over.
I mean, it is a good, it's, I guess it's our duty to talk about it around this time of year. Hey, do you want to, are you going to stay on if we go on another piece or do you have to take off?
I'll stay for maybe the next section of the episode.
Okay, all right. We're going to do a poem if Sean's into it. You feeling it, Sean? All right, we're going to do another poem. I'm going to scream.
I have a poem here by Robert Browning, one of the great Victorian poets in England. Robert Browning was born in 1812 and died in 1889. During his lifetime, his wife, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, was more famous. But I think posterity deems him the better poet. By the way, Elizabeth Barrett Browning gave us that famous series of sonnets, the sonnets from the Portuguese, with that one poem, How Do I Love Thee, Let Me Count the Ways. But this one by her husband, Robert Browning, Prospis. Fear death, to feel the fog in my throat, the mist in my face, when the snows begin and the blast denote I am nearing the place, the power of the night, the press of the storm, the post of the foe, where he stands, the arch fear in a visible form, yet the strong man must go. For the journey is done, and the summit attained, and the barriers fall. Though a battles to fight ere the guerdon be gained, the reward of it all. I was ever a fighter, so one fight more, the best and the last. I would hate that death bandaged my eyes and forbore and bade me creep past. No, let me taste the whole of it. fare like my peers, the heroes of old. Bear the brunt in a minute, pay glad life's arrears of pain, darkness, and cold. For sudden the worst turns the best to the brave, the black minutes at end. And the elements rage, the fiend voices that rave, shall dwindle, shall blend, shall change, shall become. First a peace out of pain, then a light, then thy breast. O thou soul of my soul, I shall clasp thee again, and with God be the rest.
Thank you, Sean. And I should let everyone know, whoever is listening, Sean has been on the last 6 or 7 shows reading poems. I'm in the process of making one collection of the last 7 or so episodes, including today, I believe. And we're going to post that as a bonus episode or something. And I think it'll be really cool. Because Sean is really talented at writing and reading poetry, I think. Anyway, we're going to do another one of our little promos and then a short piece, and we'll be right back.
Hi, greetings from Dublin, Ireland. This is Colm Cronin from Adventures in Advising, a higher ed podcast I co-host with Matt Markin. If you're passionate about education, working with students, and making a difference in their lives, join Matt and me as we bring together academic advisors, faculty members, student affairs professionals, and other members of the higher ed community to share knowledge, best practices, and their own stories. Find Adventures in Advising on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Humus Ex Discipulis Meis.
And that's English.
And it's I'm not sure who that is by. It's Latin.
I know, that was a joke.
A shook back on.
Izuki.
Hello?
All right. There, can you hear us?
Yep, I can hear you.
Yeah, you're on. We're back with our thoughts tonight, everyone.
Can you say the name of that piece again?
Okay, it's Umus, U-M-U-S, X-E-X, D-I-S-C-U.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay.
I think it's what do they call those? Yeah, some sort of hymn.
Gotcha.
Did you like it?
It sounded really good.
Are you going to listen
to
it?
That was, we've been, in the past, we used to play all kinds of, for those listening, we used to play all kinds of chants, but now that we've gotten a little more serious about promoting and different platforms, we kind of have to be careful about licensing and copyright. So I found these on the Creative Commons. There's a few good ones on there.
Soothing for the soul.
You know,
what's that?
I do want to promote the songs that we used to do, like the Ensemble Organum chants and the Bulgarian Orthodox chants. Like, those are classics. OG stuff. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to play those again, but like, those are some hits right there.
Yeah, we did I don't know if you remember, we did that series of like 6 episodes our first year where we were just going through the, I think, Ensemble Organum pieces.
Yeah. Dissecting them one by one.
Or maybe the Bulgarian.
Top hits.
Okay, we did both.
Yeah,
I remember there was one episode.
Only 1,000 kids will remember those.
Yeah. I remember we did have that one episode where we hit on, I think we did like 6 Bulgarian songs or something like that. It was say the Lord 3 times. Was it Praise the Lord 3 times?
Yeah, praise the Lord 3 times. We are not a religious podcast, everyone. Reminding everyone, we just like Gregorian chants. That's kind of how this started.
We like all music.
Well, let me make a comment on religious music, okay? Right. I have a feeling that most of us here at the bar and also at Shook at Home are don't have very strong religious feelings or follow any denomination in particular. But speaking personally, I find religious music, regardless of the denomination, incredibly moving. And especially if the composer is inspired by their faith. For instance, J.S. Bach signed most of his works for the glory of God, whether it is a simple harpsichord work that he wrote for his children or whether it was the great Mass in B minor for posterity. He wrote every note because of his faith and for God. It was his offer to God. And because of that, he never shirked. Every note was carefully thought out.
No cutting corners.
Right, no cutting corners. And that faith shines through in so many religious pieces, whether it's Gregorian chants from the 8th century or 9th century, whether it's J.S. Bach, whether it's Palestrina from the Renaissance writing masses or setting music for the mass, whether it is Brahms and his German Requiem, whether it's Beethoven and his Missa Solemnis, or Mozart and all his masses and, of course, his Requiem. Those works, they just
touch the soul.
Well, they touch the soul, but they also reek of the composer's faith and deep feelings.
And their influence.
Yeah, they definitely, you can feel it.
Indubitably.
What? What are you saying?
I was going to say, and it's that reminds me, obviously it could be used for something more nefarious, I suppose. For example, in the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and even modern day extremist groups, music is used a lot to sway, the members or whatnot. And that's an example of it being used for bad reasons. But there's a famous book about the Islamic Revolution, and they talk about how they would use strong male chants, in Farsi and whatnot, and to inspire the the fanatics and their religion. And it's kind of an interesting combination of the two, considering how both of them are, you know, both concepts are used for swaying emotions and whatnot.
Well, I think we should differentiate between the use of music in politics and the individual faith of a composer when they are writing a religious piece or setting religious text. Hitler, of course, used music to a great extent, as did Stalin, as, let's admit it, this country uses as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Born in the USA.
Born, well, yeah.
I think that's a parody on American life, though. That's what I've read.
It could very well be. And when you listen to it closely, I would agree with that entirely. But when you get down to the individual composer and religion, yeah, perhaps some of them are towing, let's say, I'll use the analogy of towing the party line. Poets and composers who are just speaking from the heart to the god or gods that they know, and let's not exempt goddesses from that as well. For instance, as I was born and raised a Catholic, and the Virgin Mary plays a large role in the prayers of the Catholic faith. And I'm going to quickly read a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who was born in 1844 and died in 1889. He's considered one of the masters of English poetry, although his total volume of poems is very slim. And I think this really portrays the faith of, in this case, the poet, not the composer. But I would also add that artists as well show their faith in their artwork. I would say Michelangelo, Sistine Chapel.
Caravaggio,
thank you. And what do you think about Da Vinci and The Last Supper?
Oh, yeah, I think Da Vinci's confusing because I know he did a lot of the religious works for a commission, but I think that either he was religious or he wasn't. Either way, he would throw in a lot of androgynous characters into his religious paintings, which I thought was interesting.
Okay, well, anyways, getting back to Gerard Manley Hopkins, I agree with you entirely. And that idea of commission doesn't necessarily negate faith.
Yeah, you're right. I feel like everybody had some belief at that point.
Right. It was largely a world of, before the Reformation, largely a world of Catholics. Anyways, getting back to Gerard Manley Hopkins, a poet that I really admire and one of the, I think, truly great poets. He was born Anglican. He converted to Roman Catholicism. And there are some who say that if he didn't write poetry, he might very well have been canonized as a saint. This poem is called God's Grandeur. It's one of his better known poems. God's Grandeur by Gerard Manley Hopkins. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil, crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod. And all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, can foot feel, being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, O morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings.
That's really great. I like the that last line there.
World broods with warm breast and with
right before that one.
Okay, because the Holy Ghost or
of the world something that I can't remember word for.
Let me find it for you. How about the last three lines? Oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast.
Yeah, the Holy Ghost over the bent world. That is really great imagery.
you get the feeling that he actually is a visionary and actually sees it.
Yeah, definitely. As I was listening, I imagined in my mind,
beautiful piece,
whatever it was trying to convey.
And you know, there's also another angle to this. It's actually a before the word became popular, I'm thinking before the word was even used, an environmentalist.
Really?
Right.
Oh, right. How would you say?
Let's take the middle four lines. It's if I was to analyze this form-wise, it's definitely an Italian sonnet, which means it's broken up into eight lines and answered by six lines. So it's 14 lines total, like a sonnet. And the second four lines in the octet that begins the poem, where it's all kind of like thumbs down, okay? And the middle four lines generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And that is nature under the burden of man's trade, man's raping the earth for resources,
profit.
Right, for profit. And that line, the soil is bare now, nor can foot feel because we wear shoes. We can't even feel the earth upon which we walk. We're separated from it, and we just use it. And then the last six lines, the answer to the first octet, the mood changes entirely. And for all this, nature is never spent.
That's really nice. Are you still there, Ishik?
Oh, yeah.
What are you eating, chili dogs? What's going on?
No, I've finished my chili. I'm just, you know, chilling, listening.
We're going to go to another piece by Handel and try to think of a topic to talk about. This is really hard when we don't have a topic.
I know. We're just winging it, guys.
Yeah. Well, I think we're doing
pretty good.
Okay. I think
we had somewhat of a topic.
Yes. Yeah, politics, poetry. Yeah. Essentially,
we hit all the nails on the head. Yeah.
I think we should talk about movies. We were just talking about
Air Force One. I'm so good at movies.
All right, we'll be back and we'll chat about the movies that are on our minds lately.
Love you guys. Our thoughts tonight.
Well, at least we're moving in a positive direction.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to unmute the mics. So that was a great piece. What do we have going on, Sean?
Well, Murat always surprised me with the music he plays during the break. I never hear it beforehand. So I'm always intrigued by what comes up on the moment. And the first piece we just listened to, they were both by Handel. But the first piece by Handel, George Frederick Handel, okay? So he was born 1785, same year as Bach. I think it was 1785, right? Just about the same year as Bach, okay? And so, Murat, if you could play just about 30 seconds of the first piece you played, can you do that?
Yeah, I can. Are you there, Ashik?
I am here.
Okay, so we're going to play the first 30 seconds of this Handel piece. All right, that was the first 30 seconds.
Okay, so I'm guessing that a lot of people out there in computer land recognize the music, but they don't recognize the orchestration or the lyrics. But there may be other people who may be thinking to themselves, I think I've heard that before, but I can't remember where. But the music, the melody line is from The Messiah. Now, I don't know which came first. My guess is this came before The Messiah, because here's the background for George Frederick Handel. He was born in Germany, and at one point he decided he wanted to go to England, so he asked his prince, and at that point all musicians were hired by courts, he asked his prince to let him go to England. Well, he went to England, and he made a huge killing. Get this. He made a huge killing writing operas in the Italian language for an English audience. So here's this German going to England, writing Italian operas for an English audience, because Italian opera was all the rage. It was like top 40 music. It was rock and roll of the day. It was also special effects of the day. Like, it was a combination of Super Bowl, special effects movies like Star Wars. It was everything in a big package. And so Handel made a huge amount of money writing Italian operas for the English audience. But then a fellow named John Gay came along, and he wrote an opera in the English language. And all the English went, wow, we can have opera in our own language? And that's what turned Handel to writing oratorios, which are basically unperformed operas. But they're operas in music and text, but not in staging. So my guess is that Handel stole this melody from himself, orchestrated it, and then set the English words for Messiah to this piece. That's my guess.
So the Italian came first.
I'm guessing the Italian came first. I don't know that for certain, but I'm guessing the Italian came first.
Speculation.
Right, entirely speculation, right? And so Handel started to make a big killing because Messiah was such a big success. He started to make another financial killing after almost going bankrupt, writing oratorios in English for the English audience.
Some trivia for all of you.
Well, you know, what it points out is a lot of people think that a lot of nations were isolated back then, but beginning in the late Middle Ages, it was really Europe was very fluid. Music traveled all over the continent.
A universal language.
It was a universal language. And another example is that some of the great Italian composers of the time, like Vivaldi, Albinoni, they were actually writing music that was published in Amsterdam. Okay. So that gives you an idea of how popular the music was across the continent.
I really like that piece. I heard it and I was like, yeah, we have to put this on.
Money.
Yeah. What's going on over there, Ashik?
I'm just listening. I'm more of an audience member right now. I'm just munching on.
Hey, get out of here, right away.
How does it feel to be on the other side?
It feels weird. It gives me a new perspective on the podcast.
What was that?
I mean, it
gives him a perspective.
It gives me a new perspective. Okay. Yeah, you know, I usually either I'm in the podcast or I listen to the episode after, so it's different being live and not there.
Yeah, it's interesting, honestly, for us too.
Good different or bad different?
It's good. I suppose bad different because I'm not there, but it's not
You're
bad.
You're sad about it?
I agree.
But
we're having a good time. But it's also different in the sense of, like, not how it always is. So not there's something missing for sure.
Yeah. But listen,
your wise words.
I do have to go soon, though. I've been very, let's say, very lazy with work this week. So
okay, hold on. Before
I'll
you go,
I might have to step out, huh?
Before you go, what's one of your favorite films?
My favorite film? Oh god!
Yeah, favorite
time.
Film. Yeah, top 10, top 3,
that's
whatever.
A hard question.
Shoot.
That's so hard, dude.
I know.
Okay,
what you said.
So I think one of my most that's hard. I guess most personally fulfilling, but I guess top 3. I'm not sure in which order these are, but Seventh Seal is probably one of my favorite ones. Shawshank Redemption is pretty classic, and I think it's for a good reason. And third movie, huh? God, that's hard. Third movie. I don't think this is one of my top favorite films of all time, but I think just for the shout out of the movie, I'll say Valhalla Rising is a really cool movie about basically the psychological. It's kind of a psychological thriller, and it explores Norsemen and Crusader hypothetical adventures into the new world, and it's very scary, and it's very gory, and it's
I like
very
that.
Just like a main character doesn't talk at all. It's very psychological. So I'd probably go with those three for somewhere in the top.
That's pretty good.
I think those are great choices. So if you have to go, we'll catch up with you later. We're gonna continue on with this conversation.
Yeah. Miss you, buddy.
Yeah, and I'll be there for the next episode, most likely. Look forward to the new Arthos Tonight episode, the next one, which will most likely be about mythology. So.
Mythology, yeah.
Yeah.
Mythical creatures.
Different types of mythology. Nordic mythology, mm-hmm. Greek mythology, Egyptian mythology, whatever comes to Arthos.
Or
does
it was supposed
night.
To be this week, but, you know, we had some complications, but we're holding it down.
Yeah. All right.
Sean,
all right, well, I'll see you guys later,
say?
Man.
All right, later,
you.
Buddy. We love you.
Sean, what would
see
you
later.
Say is your, off the top of your head, top 3 movies?
oh, my gosh. I'm dating myself, but I'm a huge fan of David Lean's films. Now, David Lean was a director in the 60s.
Yeah.
He did Lawrence of Arabia. He did Dr. Zhivago. And he did Bridge Over the River Kwai, among other things.
Yeah.
And those three movies grip me from beginning to end. And they're very long, right? David Lean is an epic director, or a director of epics, to put it another way.
Yeah.
But I would say, off the top of my head, that if they're not my top 3, they're definitely amongst my top 10.
Feel that.
And there's one other film that I want to mention that if you haven't seen it, it's an incredibly intriguing film. It's a Russian film called Russian Ark.
Russian Ark?
Russian Ark. And
when
I don't remember.
Come out?
You
don't know. It's
okay. Yeah, I want to say 1980s. Oh. But what makes this film so incredibly intriguing, it's about the St. Petersburg Palace, which is now a famous museum, and it's a film that I think it's the only film that was ever done in one big take. There's no editing. It's just this camera running the whole time for about 90 minutes, and it's just one big take. And I'll tell you what, it's an intriguing film.
My top three favorite films. Number one. Number one is the cartoon rendition of The Sword in the Stone, probably still to this day, from when I saw it when I was 5 years old. Second one, probably Gangs of New York, which is like early on New York before it was
the one with Denzel.
Denzel. Daniel. Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, okay.
And
I'm
not Denzel.
About a different movie.
Not Daniel. Not Denzel Washington. And then my third one, man, I don't know. My third favorite film, I don't know. I got a lot of favorite films. I like all types of different movies, horrors and horror films and mystery films. And
so you said your first two, right?
Yeah, The Sword in the Stone and Gangs in New York. I'd probably say like a Quentin Tarantino film like Pulp Fiction or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Those are really good. I can't argue with either or. Any Quentin Tarantino film as a third is probably one of my favorite films. All of them are my favorite, so. But yeah. Amadeus is also really good,
oh,
too.
Yeah. Such a good movie.
I
think it's underrated.
I mean,
I know people think it's a great film, but I think it needs more.
Murat is the one that showed me Amadeus. If you've never seen Amadeus, look up Amadeus, because it is an extraordinary film, and it's a really, really good. And it's also very sad, but what film isn't? So. Yeah, on true tragedies.
And Murat?
Yeah.
My three favorite films. I've been so detached from watching movies. Like whenever I watch a movie, it's so sporadic and unplanned that I've been studying for like the last really hard for the last 2 years, so I haven't been watching too many movies. But man, all right,
you got it.
Okay, so I've always said number one, American Psycho.
Oh my gosh, how come I did not say this? That movie is so good.
Just because, aside from the
Christian Bale,
the nefarious aspect of Patrick Bateman.
Patrick Bateman.
He was a huge influence on who I am as a person, minus the serial killing and the narcissism. I just think he's so cool in one way. I like his style.
He's an extraordinary character.
Yeah, I think he's a cool character. Just the way that Christian Bale plays him, though, you know, minus the killing, but the way he dresses, the way he talks and everything, it was like really influential to me in my early 20s.
Well, the killing was all like supposedly all within his head. It was like in a notebook. He didn't really
something
kill
like
anybody.
That. Exactly. There's different interpretations on how it actually was.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
Oh, can I add one more?
Yeah.
Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh.
I should have added that as number three, not a Quentin Tarantino film. That is the best cult film I've ever seen in my life.
And those two are similar.
Yeah, they're very similar. We watched both those together.
Yeah.
You showed me both of those.
Yeah, those are the type of movies that make you unsettled, but they're something about the both of those two movies. It's like nothing happens the entire movie.
Yeah.
But at the end of it, you feel confused. Kind of like the new Joker movie.
There's like subliminal messages, and every time that you watch it over and over and over again, you find new theories of your own, or you'll rewatch it because someone told you they saw something in a scene, and you'll analyze it to the point where like you realize that you've watched it 30 times and you're like, you find something new every time.
So let's see, is it American Psycho number one? I'd say honorable mention would be Eyes Wide Shut as well. Number two, I would say come on now.
Come on, mate.
Come on now.
I'm good.
I'm just trying. I'm apparently spacing all the movies that I like. Space Jam.
Oh, yeah.
Number two, Space Jam. Maybe not so much anymore, but, you know.
Sentimental.
Yeah, it's growing up, that
Same.
Was a, you know, Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Great movie. I must have watched that movie. I watched that movie so many times that my sister hid it from me so she didn't have to watch it anymore.
Yeah. Even if she enjoyed it just as much as you.
Yeah. To a certain point.
You told me that.
And then third, I would say more recent one, probably The Big Short.
Oh, that's a good
which
film
is also
too.
Another Christian Bale movie.
Yeah. Isn't Brad Pitt in that film too?
Brad Pitt,
Christian Bale,
Steve Carell.
Steve Carell, yeah.
And then a couple other people. Gosling, Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, Ryan Gosling. That's an A+ cast.
That is, yeah, that's a good one.
You can't get any better than that.
It's a good story. I mean, it's a true story.
I like how Christian Bale is like a secret drummer with pencils on his desk.
Yeah. Michael Burry, he's a real guy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So what I'm also hearing in the comments of you two is repeated watchings.
Especially with American Psycho.
Yeah, does a film sustain itself over repeated watchings? And there's an analogy here to like reading mysteries. Once you find out who done it, do you want to read that mystery again?
Yeah.
Now, depending on how well it's written, you might, right? If it's Sherlock Holmes, you might go back to that story again.
Or Poirot.
Right?
Or Poirot. Agatha Christie, right?
Agatha Christie, yeah.
I think what it all comes down to is the portrayal of the character, the main character, or the main antagonist, or whatever. And there's not one set of view, but multiple. It can be analyzed in any kind of situation, you know, depending on the situation and what it is.
Well, you mentioned American Psycho.
Yeah. It's like, oh, no, he did.
Okay.
But yeah, but that guy's he's a businessman with a lot of internal personal problems.
Struggles.
But the way that it's portrayed on film is it's kind of like the movie The Joker. You don't know what's real and what's not.
Yeah, for sure. Really.
It's kind of like looking at a piece of art and your opinion is your opinion and your opinion alone. And the only one that can understand it is like the person that's standing in front of it. If that makes any sense. And those are the kind of films that I like to go back and analyze over and over again. Or historical films or musical films or documentaries or whatever. Yeah.
Because I'm of the opinion that the best films can be watched many times, and each time, if you're lucky, it seems new.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of Shakespeare, okay? Me and the Bard are good buddies. And I can watch Shakespeare plays, even in a lousy production, and still be intrigued by the play. And there are a lot of really good productions of Shakespeare plays, which I really enjoy immensely, even though I mentioned David Lean before. But Shakespeare is, even though it's been done many times in movies, I don't necessarily consider them movies as much as plays.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful version from the 60s of Romeo and Juliet. And The Taming of the Shrew with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
And also Michael York's in that, and he's one of the great actors. And he was in that really good musical. Star Joel Grey was set in Nazi Germany. Come on, Brain, you can come up with it. It's a 1960s film.
Was this the one you were talking about where they try to con the old ladies?
No, that's the producers. That's the producers. Right. That's with Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel.
I want to go and watch that.
And that's a musical. And musicals.
Gene Wilder is a great actor.
I agree.
He's one of my favorite actors of all time. And comedian.
Well, then you should watch the producers. And that goes back to musicals. Now, a good musical will sustain itself over many views. Because, like, we listen to the same songs over and over and over again. We can watch the same musical over and over again because we like the song so much.
Yeah.
Right? Like Hello, Dolly.
Or you're trying to learn it or study it.
Right. I mean, Hello, Dolly with Barbara Streisand is a one, and the dancing scenes in that. Oh, my goodness.
So I said American Psycho, 2, Space Jam. Space Jam, I want to move to 4. Because 2, I want to put Casino Royale.
Oh, yeah.
Because James Bond, yeah. I'd say, is more influential.
Bond. James Bond.
I feel like I, not to rag on my dad or anything. Growing up, my dad, I don't know, my dad's cool. My dad's cool to me now, but I didn't think he was that cool growing up. So I was looking at, like, James Bond and
yeah.
people like that. So James Bond was really cool growing up. Now I want to actually be an agent, so that's probably...
Yeah, they were trying to sell the new film, you said, or something like that.
Yeah,
a couple. Yeah, to Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. It was like billion something dollars.
$500 million.
Yeah, $500 million.
MGM. Yeah.
And no one wanted to buy it.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is, but.
But I don't know if it would. You know, there's a lot of young people that aren't into Bond anymore.
I think the reason why they're trying to sell it for like capital is because of they saw what happened to Mulan and Disney.
Yeah, yeah. That
putting out a film. And then charging people for like something that they're already paying for a movie.
Yeah, what are they charge? Try to charge
$30 or $35 or something like $35.99,
yeah.
something like that.
All right, so we did three favorite movies. How about top three characters in a book or a movie?
Top three characters in a book or a movie.
Yeah.
So since Zach's on the phone, this is Sean. I'm gonna take this one first. Top three characters in a movie or a book.
Hang on. I gotta go to the phone. All right, so yeah. Top three characters in a book or a movie. Zach's taking off here in just a moment.
Top three characters in a book or a movie. I would say Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, because he's cool. He's like Merlin. I'm pretty sure he's the reason why Gandalf is who he is because of Merlin from Sword in the Stone. It was based off of him. I don't know. two other people from movies or film.
Yeah. Gandalf is number one.
Yeah, for
really?
Me.
Really?
Yeah. I like wizards. I like people with magical abilities.
See, it's hard to think about these when you're on the spot.
Yeah, no.
But that's how it really counts. Like a Rorschach ink blot test.
What's the character's name from Pulp Fiction that Samuel L. Jackson plays?
Jules,
number two.
Yeah, Jules.
Because he recites the Bible.
Yeah.
Not that I'm like religious or anything. Yeah, I did go to church, but I think it's really cool that the guy can vividly recite from the Bible from within his head.
Yeah.
And as he carries out executions.
He's a cold motherfucker.
Yeah. And Jamie Foxx in Django Unchained.
Oh, and that's a great character too.
A man that is that was a slave at one point, and then fights for his freedom with
what is that German guy's name?
Christopher Waltz.
Yeah, Christopher Waltz. He is a great actor, like one of my favorite actors of all time. That's
one, two, and three right there.
But
you taking off?
Yeah, I got to take off. Those are my thoughts tonight, and God bless you all, and I'll talk to you on Saturday probably.
All right, we'll see you.
All right, love you guys.
We're still here for another.
Call in.
We'll probably finish off our top three and lead out with a piece and a poem.
So you're putting me on the spot.
You're on the spot, Sean.
Top three characters.
It's just you and me left.
Okay.
I bet you could think of a couple great ones from a book.
I almost have too many. And mine are all going to come from books, I think. And they will also show how culturally illiterate I am as far as contemporary culture. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to try to do it in chronological order. My first choice would be Achilles in the Iliad by Homer.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's a great choice.
Not that he's an admirable character. In some ways he is. But the way he moves from his anger to acceptance of his humanity. He becomes almost inhuman at some point. And then when Priam visits him to beg for the body of his son Hector, Achilles is transformed, changed back to a very empathetic and sympathetic human creature. And that's basically Homer's theme in that is what makes us human. And I think Achilles is just one of those great dynamic characters in literature. You might find him not all the time admirable in the way he kills Hector and drags his body around Troy at behind his chariot, but he is truly a dynamic and in the end, heroic and sympathetic character.
Mm-hmm. Legendary, I would say.
Yeah, certainly legendary, because there have been so many takes on Achilles since then. For instance, like Brad Pitt in the movie Troy, which I think he does a great job depicting Achilles in that.
Yeah, I agree.
And the next one, and again, there's lots of choices here, but one that comes to mind is King Lear by Shakespeare.
Zach is taking off, everyone.
Up, up the nine.
And King Lear, King Lear comes across at the opening of the play as a very stupid old man, very stupid and vain old man. But the transformation he goes through during the course of that play is absolutely stunning. The way he comes to realize the nature of evil and the nature of himself and his own wrongs. When he carries Cordelia's body out on stage in one of the last scenes of the play, it is truly heartbreaking as he realizes all that he has brought about by his initial decision to let his daughters, his stupid question of asking his daughters, how much do you love me? And that determines how much of the kingdom you'll get. But yeah, King Lear is, I think, one of the truly great, great characters in literature. And my third one is Leopold Bloom from Ulysses by James Joyce. One of the most humanitarian characters in literature. You might find him weak in some points. The story is that he leaves home knowing his wife is going to have an affair that day with Blazes Boylan. And yet he accepts that. And there's lots of extenuating circumstances behind that. The loss of a child that died very young. And so he and Molly have not had sex for a number of years. But at the end of the book, he comes out as one, as a great hero and a great human being. And you know, people often ask you if you had the choice to sit down and have a beer with a number of people. I think if Leopold Bloom was an actual human being, I would really like to sit down and have a Guinness with that guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Sounds like a really pragmatic, down-to-earth person.
But when he has to be heroic, he does rise to it. When he meets the so-called Cyclops, the citizen, chapters, and the citizen is both xenophobic and anti-Jewish, Leopold talks him down, although Joyce, in his typical fashion, gives an ironic twist at the end of the chapter. But yeah, Leopold Bloom stands toe-to-toe with this nationalist in this bar. And it's a very heroic stance. And also his kindness toward many people and his kindness toward birds. And it shows up again. And his insight into death at the burial scene early in the novel. He is truly, I think, an admirable, though not entirely in the traditional sense, heroic characters.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my three.
Yeah. I was I was writing some papers this weekend, and I copy-paste the paper, all the contents of it into a word counter online just to make sure I have enough words, And it tells you the level of reading, the reading level of, your writing. And I was really curious as to how they come up with that. So I looked it up, and there's a whole system, it's an equation. And, it's read from 0 to 10 or 0 to 15 to 20 to 30 and 30 to 40, which is the most complex. And I guess somehow I stumbled across the most complex reading, and James Joyce's books were, all over that list. And I've never actually read any of his stuff, but that's interesting to me. Like, I can't understand how writing would be complicated. Maybe that's a good thing for me that I don't find everything or very much writing complicated, but it's interesting because I feel like you just have to take the time to really digest it.
Well, if you have, before you get to your top three, if you have a moment sometime this week, I'm pretty sure you can find at least part of it online, but just to open up the first chapter of Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce, the book he wrote after Ulysses, his last book, which took him decades to write. But just read the opening paragraph, and I think you get an idea of how complex it is.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, I'm not doubting. I'm not trying to overestimate myself here, but yeah, I wasn't trying to overestimate my reading ability.
No, I didn't take it that way. Yeah. But you're,
I will though. I really want to.
But that might be that in Ulysses, because Ulysses changes style every chapter.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in one chapter, he changes styles almost every few pages.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure it's confusing to, especially if you're, you know, English second language or something like that.
Well, that's why there are especially written books like The Keys to Finnegan's Wake, Reader's Guide to James, to Ulysses. Yes.
That's interesting.
Yes.
There's a, I also in that whole system that grades the writing, there was the most difficult types of writing are economists, mathematicians, psychologists, and philosophers.
Probably specialized journals,
mm-hmm.
like the American Medical Association journal.
Oh, yeah.
Right? When you open up that, it might as well be Swahili.
Yeah. There's a lot of jargon. Let's see. My top three. Number one is easy, I think, 007. I don't know what it is. I mean, it's cheesy and it's an easy choice, but I think that character stands the test of time. James Bond. I mean, he's just that cool guy. You know, he's got, I think most of all, it's his charisma and his abilities.
So do you have a favorite? You've watched a lot of James Bond films?
Oh, yeah, I've seen him.
Do you have a favorite James Bond?
Definitely Daniel Craig, the newest, most recent, and Sean Connery.
So the newest and oldest.
Newest and oldest, yeah. They're all great, I think, so for the most part. But there's just something about the way, I don't know, he's a polymath to a degree. You know, he's charismatic, he's fit, he's intelligent. He can, you know, he has the cars, he's got the suits. He's a eclectic.
And his eye's always on the ball.
Exactly. He never slips up. Even when he does, he recovers quickly. The Joker, number two, not a great character, kind of, you know, messy. I think he's like a representation of the evil tendencies within humanity, but really also an anti-hero because he's very human at the same time, I think, at least certain depictions. And three, I would say Lieutenant Aldo Rain from Inglourious Basterds, which is, I think you just purchased that one recently, right, Sean?
I haven't watched it yet, though.
Yeah, I think you'll understand.
Is that the Brad Pitt character?
That's Brad Pitt's character. Oh, he's so great. He's just, I don't know how to explain it, but he's very American.
So let me backtrack to the Joker. Uh-huh. Do you have Keith Ledger in mind in that?
Yeah, Heath Ledger would be.
Heath Ledger, I'm sorry. Yeah, Heath Ledger.
And also Mark Hamill. He does the voiceover for the cartoon version.
Does he really?
Yeah, yeah.
Luke Skywalker?
Yeah, Luke Skywalker.
Oh,
he does the
okay.
Joker.
Okay.
That's a really amazing version. He's less human, obviously, because it's cartoon. But he does an amazing job. I think after Heath Ledger, I would think of Mark Hamill as the Joker, and then the newest Joaquin, and then Jack Nicholson, blah, blah, blah. But I think there's so many good Jokers that kind of like James Bond that they're, and you said Achilles too, right? They're different versions. And it's that type of a character is, you can tell the character is deep when when somebody else plays the character and there's a new depth to that character.
Well, don't you think so many heroes are just dumb, big, strong guys that are doing good, but it's really the criminals that are the most intriguing characters.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, maybe not Luke, though. Luke Skywalker. Because he's just a kid. But for the most part, yeah, you're right. Like, the anti-hero is the one that a lot of people are drawn to.
Like Dr. Moriarty.
What's that from?
Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, I've never seen any Sherlock Holmes or read any Sherlock Holmes.
Okay.
Believe it or not.
He's the arch-villain.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's the arch-villain.
I need to catch up with that because it's like proto-criminal minds, right? Mystery stuff. So we've got one last promo, and we'll close out with a piece. Any final thought, Sean?
Oh, I think we've covered a lot of ground tonight.
You're right. Somehow we filled the 2 hours without a shit.
I'm glad though we ended on a positive note. As
yeah,
opposed to, like, it started off pretty low with serial killers. And...
yeah, you're right. But you're right. Like the anti-heroes in our life, that stuff does exist. Here we go. So this last promo I'm doing is from a marijuana-based podcast called A Couple of Guys. That sent in their promo to me called The High Guys.
Are they going to give us freebies?
Maybe. I don't know. So this is The High Guys, and we'll close you guys out with a piece. Have a great evening.
Hi, guys.
We're The High Guys.
We are two guys who like to get high and talk about
Love, Victor.
Drag Race.
Legendary.
Tuca and Birdie. A lot of stuff. Each episode, we give you, the listeners, reasons to watch whatever the topic of discussion is.
Then we like to dig into the show and analyze it with our guests. We cover topics such as representation in media, LGBTQ+ culture, alcoholism, and mental health.
Aside from that, we are also very high, so shenanigans are aplenty.
Hee hee, girl. Oh my god, hee hee, girl, do it for me.
Started during the Harlem Renaissance. In 1920. I'm sorry. I'm so high.
Jinx is a drag version of Mr. Mime.
The hat comes off, the wig comes on.
We hope you give our show a listen and walk away with some insight and with a smile.
Now take a hit and hit play.
Take a hit and hit play. I really like that. So I guess Sean is going to read a poem and then we'll play a piece. We'll send you guys off with this.
So we've been talking about movies and characters that intrigue us and that we keep going back to again and again. This poem by John Keats, who was born in 1795 and died in 1821. Yes, died tragically young. But one of the most precocious poets in the English language. If you read his early poetry, it's a little bit sappy. But by the time you get to his last works, they are some of the masterpieces of English literature. Excuse me. And I'm going to read one that I have heard that some critics think the most perfect poem in the English language, or as close to perfect as a poem can be. And it also fits the season. It's one of my favorite poems. I'm not a very good judge of whether it's a level of perfection here, but I can tell you the way it's formed, the way it sounds, the way it unfolds, it really is a beautiful poem. And it's called To Autumn by John Keats. Season of mist and mellow fruitfulness, close friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run. To bend with apples the moss cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core. To swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel. To set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think the warm days will never cease. For summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amidst thy store, Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a greenery floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow, sound asleep, drowned with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cider press, with patient look, thou watchest the last oozings, hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too. While barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue, then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as a light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn, hedge crickets sing, and now, with treble soft, the redbreast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies.
Thank you.